without hardship, without pain, we do not value prosperity, happiness, and ease. It's through those difficulties that we understand the value of hardship, and it's through those challenges that we actually understand the value of ease and comfort and tranquility. Inshallah, you will be patient in your life. Hardships are there, but in Allah ma'as sabreen, Allah is with those who are patient. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows.
In 2009, David Mendoza Herarte was extradited from Spain to the United States on condition he be allowed to serve his sentence in Spain. I have obtained classified documents which show the diplomatic assurances given by the U.S. Embassy in Madrid to Spain and how the United States violated the conditions of his extradition. Court documents sent to me show how the United States denied his transfer application numerous times. Mendoza spent over 6 years in the United States fighting to get back to Spain. While in prison, Mendoza sued both the United States and Spain for failing to uphold the conditions of his extradition and violating his human rights. His case is so extraordinary and such a miscarriage of justice that it was recently taken up by the United Nations. In October, Mendoza's case was mentioned in the English High Court, where the United States is now trying to extradite Julian Assange to the US. The United States has offered very similar diplomatic assurances, saying that Assange can serve his sentence in his home country, Australia. Assange's lawyers cited Mendoza's case as proof that these diplomatic assurances from the United States cannot be trusted. James Lewis, the lead U.S. prosecutor, told the High Court that, quote, "The United States has never broken a diplomatic assurance." Will these documents, these classified diplomatic communications and court documents, paint a completely different picture? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. David Mendoza Herarte was born and raised in the United States, but he described Spain to me as his second home. He is both an American and Spanish citizen. Mendoza was wanted by the United States for drug trafficking in the early 2000s, moving marijuana between Canada across the border into Seattle. Mendoza first realized that U.S. authorities were onto him when he found a GPS tracker stuck on the bottom of his car. He told me that teams were put on him to survey him 24 hours a day, with federal agents even renting a house across the street from him. Mendoza dropped everything and decided to leave the United States for Mexico to stay at some property that he owned there. When he learned that there was a warrant out for his arrest, he moved to the Spanish capital, Madrid, in June 2006. 2 years later, in June 2008, the Spanish authorities arrested Mendoza under an international arrest warrant. The United States had requested his extradition on drug-related and money laundering charges. At this point, Mendoza had already settled in Spain and started a family. He was married and had one child with another on the way, both Spanish nationals. This is important because in Spain, if you go to jail, the government can't just put you in a facility that is so far away that it would prevent your family or make it practically impossible for them to see you. This is the right to private and family life under Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights. Now, in August 2008, the Spanish National Court ruled that Mendoza's extradition to the United States could only go ahead under three conditions. Number one, that he serve any sentence in Spain, so he would be close to his family. Number two, no life sentence could be handed down. Number three, that he would not be tried for currency structuring. Spanish judges made two very clear rulings on this in August and November 2008. If the United States wanted to extradite David Mendoza, it had to send him back to Spain to serve his sentence. In January 2009, the United States Embassy in Madrid sent this. This is the classified diplomatic assurance given to Spain regarding Mendoza. The diplomatic assurance was worrying because it did not specifically state that Mendoza would be sent to Spain to serve his sentence. It only said that the United States, quote, does not object to Mendoza making an application to serve his sentence in Spain. Something that the United States cannot do anyway because every prisoner has the right to apply for a treaty transfer anyway. A few months ago, in July 2021, the United States offered very similar diplomatic assurances to the United Kingdom so they could extradite Julian Assange. They said that Assange could serve a sentence in his home country, Australia. Now, here's the issue. It's not enough for the United States to say that it will let Assange go to Australia. Australia also has to consent to the transfer. Otherwise, it's meaningless. And I can tell you, as one of the only journalists covering Assange's extradition, Australia has said nothing about taking Assange. Now, in Mendoza's case, the United States diplomatic assurances to Spain were very ambiguous and vaguely worded. However, this next document, signed by the United States Embassy in Madrid, was certainly not. This document is called the Acta de Entrega, or Deed of Surrender. And what it says is very clear. The Acta de Entrega states that Mendoza was surrendered to U.S. authorities, and more importantly, it confirms that he was handed over, quote, in accordance with what was previously stipulated by Section 2 of the National Criminal Court. This means whoever signs this document agrees to the terms and conditions given by the Spanish court. They agree that Mendoza must serve his sentence in Spain. And who signed this document? The United States Embassy, David Mendoza, and Spain. On April 30th, 2009, David Mendoza Herarte was extradited to the United States right after signing this Acta de Entrega. Prosecutors threatened Mendoza with over 20 years in prison if he didn't hand over more of his property. The U.S. government had already taken $14 million worth of assets and properties from Mendoza, with most of them having nothing to do with narcotics or anything illicit. Mendoza was later sentenced and given 14 years in prison. He asked the court to respect the conditions of his extradition and send him back to Spain so he could carry out his sentence, as agreed. But it now became clear that the United States had no intention of sending Mendoza back to Spain. They had squeezed him for every last penny and then violated the diplomatic assurances given to Spain. I spoke with Damon Mendoza. I asked him about his sentencing and how he found out that the United States never planned on actually sending him to Spain.
When I started getting a smell, a whiff, that they weren't going to comply with any of this, was when he asked me, because I said, Your Honor, there's some conditions that I want the court to recognize in respect of why Spain sent me, extradited me to the United States that are required of the extradition. And he looked at me and he put his glasses down and he said, young man, he said, and I said, one of those conditions were I am to serve my sentence in Spain as promised. And he said, young man, he said, are you familiar with the international instrument that has brought you to the United States? I said, yes. Do you know the name of that instrument? I said, yeah, it's the Spanish-U.S. extradition treaty. And he said, correct. He said, can I ask you another question? I said, obviously, you're the judge. He says, are you signatory on that? And I said, signatory? I said, obviously not. It's done by my government. Yours is done by your government, but it applies to all of us. He said, it does apply, but if you're not signatory, you don't have a right to claim. Meaning my government would have to make a claim against non-compliance of the treaty or the conditions that were applied within that treaty, not me. So right then I knew this is not looking good.
What the United States was essentially saying here is that Mendoza, his signature is not on the extradition treaty, so he can't make any claims, which is ridiculous because the extradition treaties in general are signed between countries, between governments, not people. Nevertheless, this is the argument that they made. Mendoza is certain that the United States government will play this exact same trick on Julian Assange. Assange will get to the United States. They might block his transfer to Australia or place him in oppressive prison conditions. And if he tries to contest this, they will say, hey, you didn't sign the extradition treaty. You have no claim. In Mendoza's case, however, there was a document that he, the United States, and Spain all signed together, which explicitly stated that he must serve his sentence in Spain, and it is the Acta de Entrega. All three signatures are right here. Now, Mendoza was given 14 years in prison. Instead of immediately sending him to Spain to carry out the sentence, he was told that he has to apply for a treaty transfer. He did. And the answer that he got from the United States was no.
I applied for a treaty transfer. They just told me, the embassy, I spoke to the Spanish embassy. It said, go ahead and just apply. You'll be back in a couple months to serve your sentence. I was sentenced to 14 years in federal prison for possession and distribution of marijuana. So I said, okay, let me apply to go back to Spain. So I applied, I think it was November 2009. It was towards the tail end of 2009, because they wouldn't allow me to apply there at the detention center. They said, oh no, we have to process you into prison. And I could see this was just a game play. So I said, screw it. I called up the embassy. I told them, listen, these guys are playing games. I need to apply and you need to help me make that application. They refused. They said, no, you have to do it through your case manager. So when I got to Colorado, they sent me to a medium-high institution in Colorado. When I got to Colorado, I asked the case manager there, who was assigned to me. I said, sir, there's some conditions. And he said, you can apply, but there's the United States is going to be told by anybody what to do. I said, all right. I mean, that's your position. There's to each their own. So I applied in 2009. And I was denied 6 months later in 2010. I think the summer, June or July 2010. So then I started saying, wait a minute here. You know, you guys took an extra piece of property from me. I've got a contract. You promised Spain. It's black and white. And that's what I knew. We're going to have some serious problems here.
In total, Mendoza applied three times to transfer to Spain. All three applications were denied, violating the extradition conditions. Once he applied, he had to wait 8 months for a decision and even longer to apply again. This is the document from the U.S. Department of Justice denying his transfer in 2010. It states, there is no administrative appeal from this decision. Unless otherwise noted above, the prisoner may reapply 2 years after this denial. When the United States denied Mendoza's transfer in 2010, he immediately sued Spain. He figured the United States is not going to give him any justice. So he needs to get justice in Spain. He wanted to pressure Spain to pressure the U.S. to enforce the extradition conditions. Mendoza sued Spain in the criminal court, the constitutional courts, but got nowhere. His last option was the civil court. So in 2014, Mendoza filed two lawsuits against Spain. Number one, that the conditions of his extradition had been violated. And number two, that his human rights had been violated. Each case went to the Spanish Supreme Court. Mendoza won both.
So when the Supreme Court ruling came out a couple of weeks later, it said, I don't care what you do, you need, first of all, it said that they were in total disbelief. It shows you the control and intimidation the United States has on these people. They were in total disbelief that the Spanish authorities only sent out two diplomatic notes saying, oh, over now at this point, a 6-year period of time, oh, could you please send Dave Mendoza back? It's required.
Two notes.
Two diplomatic notes. They were in total disbelief. The Spanish Supreme Court said, that's unacceptable. And they basically told him, if you can't resolve this, we will resolve it. And then a few weeks later came out my human rights violations. My human rights were being violated. So the Supreme Court made it very clear to him in that order that said, if this lasts any longer, we will take the actions necessary. And I asked my attorney, what actions are those? And she told me, Dave, those actions are, they're the only ones who can suspend a treaty. The court can actually suspend the extradition treaty between Spain and the United States. And she says, they don't want that to happen. This is your ticket home. They don't want that to happen because once they suspend the treaty, they can't cancel it, but they can suspend it because they say, well, it's not protecting the law and constitution of Spain. But when they suspend it, to reactivate that treaty, it has to go through the whole Congress and Parliament thing. And then it becomes highlighted, and then people start seeing it, and then the EU, other member states start seeing it. And these guys like to do things under the radar. And so that's when they said, we'll get them back.
At the same time Mendoza was suing Spain, there was also pressure coming from inside the country. Spanish judges didn't block, but stopped processing extraditions to the United States. They were basically telling the Americans, you better send Mendoza back if you want extraditions to the U.S. to continue.
So finally, I wrote the Chief Justice. I wrote all the justices of the federal court, but I got a break when I wrote the Chief Justice. He wrote me back. He sent me a stack of documents. And he called in the U.S. Embassy personnel, I suspect Kimberly Weiss and company, and said, you're gonna make this guy come back, because if not, we're gonna cut your extraditions. As of this point, extraditions have been very fluid and very fructiferous, as he puts it, for the American authorities. They promised him, no, yeah, don't worry, Mendoza will be back by the summer. That ruling was September 2011. They said I'd be back in Spain by 2012. They promised him that. Well, didn't work. And so what they did, the Spanish judges, they have no authority to cancel or suspend any extradition treaty, but they were able to not process them. Like, you have a stack of extradition requests, we're gonna put the Americans have on the bottom. That was pissing off the United States. So there was a lot of, I understand there was a lot of diplomatic communications going back. How can we get this resolved? Blah, blah, blah.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So at this point, Mendoza was suing Spain at the Supreme Court, and he was also suing the United States in civil court. He was suing Obama's Attorney General, Eric Holder. And the United States came and told Mendoza, if he drops the lawsuit in the U.S., they'll let him go home. In the end, Mendoza reluctantly accepted, but he told me that dropping this suit was the biggest regret of his life.
In 2000 to 2012 or 13, whenever they changed the law, was a 6-year maximum sentence. Now remember, the acts of my crime were in 2006 and before, supposedly. Mm-hmm. I was sentenced in 2009. I requested to go back to Spain in 2009, which was denied. If they would have sent me back to Spain, I would have been back in Spain, which the Supreme Court said, yes, he should have been back in Spain in 2009 when he requested. That's what the condition was. There was no new law then in Spain. When I get back to Spain, this judge, who's now the Minister of Interior, I don't know what the hell, he's one of these neoliberals here in Spain. This judge basically says no. Well, first he told my attorney, yes, don't worry, Dave's gonna get out. 3 days later, my attorney comes visit me in prison in Spain and says, I got bad news for you. I had a second discussion, communication with him, and he says, he's not letting you out. Somebody touched him. I said, what do you mean somebody touched him? He said, somebody told him that ain't happening. I have no doubt it was Miss Kimberly Weiss, you know, and I suspect what she did was, the Americans are pissed. I want you to know that we don't want Mendoza out.
When Spain conditioned Mendoza's extradition, when it said that he must serve his sentence in Spain, it imposed this condition in order to protect the nucleus of the family. That's the whole point. And in the end, the United States succeeded in violating the whole essence of this requirement. Mendoza's family and relationships suffered tremendously from his extradition and the fact that the United States kept him there for almost 7 years, violating the requirements of the Spanish court.
2 years in my sentence, my wife divorced me. Understood why. You know, I said, it's got a 14-year sentence. Doesn't look good here. So she divorced me. You know, I didn't hold that against her. I understood it. Everything that the court, Spanish court, attempted to establish on that condition, the United States successfully destroy. And why, I'm not quite sure even yet, but they did. You know, you and I have had discussions as to maybe why, but then we'll get into that. But they destroyed. My two little boys, who are now 12 and 13, don't call me Dad. They call me David. My mother and father passed away while I was in prison. It is what it is. You know, and I know there's people out there, well, you got yourself in that position, you got to swallow it. Yeah, but that doesn't allow you to break the law. That doesn't allow you to break the law.
In 2013, a French court blocked the extradition of Michael and Linda Mastro to the U.S., citing Mendoza's case as proof that France could not trust assurances from the United States. Mendoza has helped many others fighting extraditions in the U.S., and he hopes that his case will also help Julian Assange. Assange faces up to 175 years in a U.S. prison for publishing evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. The United States has offered assurances that it won't place Assange in special administrative measures, or SAMs, which are known as the worst prison conditions, complete isolation. The U.S. also said that Assange could serve a potential sentence in Australia, in his home country.
They said they would consent to Julian Assange's transfer to Australia. But let me show you something here. And I'm as familiar with this as most anybody. This is a treaty, the Convention of Strasbourg, to allow prisoners to transfer from one country to another. Okay? This is the international instrument that allows that to take place. They made very clear that, oh yeah, they have no problems. They will allow him to be transferred to Australia. I can tell you what they're going to do. The treaty obligates all parties must agree to the transfer. That means, okay, the United States have given their consent. Obviously, Julian Assange will say yes. But we have no assurances that the Aussies will say yes. They're one of the Five Eyes. I can tell you they're going to probably say, uh-uh. Just like that has happened on not one, I'm telling you, all the inmates in federal prison, well, not all of them, but the ones in Fort Dix would come to me that had extradition issues because they saw me as the go-to guy. And they would say, how can we force this? And you know what the United States would say? It's not us. We've given the consent. What they would do is the United States has these backdoor communications with the Canadian government. At that time, Harper was involved, who was a conservative. Don't ask for the transfer. Sorry, not asking for your transfer. It's not us. We've complied with the document. So for that to have any weight, the most minimal weight, and they're going to try and screw them anyway, the Aussies need to say, we agree to that too. They need to send a diplomatic note.
When it comes to Julian Assange, Mendoza made something very clear. Diplomatic assurances like this need to be signed by all three parties. That means the U.S., the U.K., and Julian Assange, okay? Because if either party refuses to comply, Assange can go and contest that in a United States court, despite him not being a signatory of the extradition treaty. Because the first thing the U.S. will say is, well, you did not sign the extradition treaty between the U.S. and the U.K. You don't have any claim. But if there is a contract with all three signatures, Assange does have a claim. Now, regarding Assange carrying out a sentence in Australia, the United States needs to explicitly say in the diplomatic note that it consents to his transfer. But that's not everything, as Mendoza explains.
And then within that diplomatic note, it should say Julian Assange has a right to contest any of these conditions if they are not applied correctly, or if one of the parties find non-application, okay? They're not just Julian Assange, the U.S. government, or give the right to all of them. But they all three need to have that right to contest those documents. I'm a nobody. And they went to the extent of this to do it to a nobody. Can you imagine what they're going to do to them? I mean, if all these promises that they're making for Julian, or making to the court on behalf of Julian, do you think they're, I mean, I'm a nobody. And not just that. If he doesn't have a signed contract that he's signatory of and that specifically stipulates that he can sue the Americans as equally as the Brits for not compliance with this.
The lead prosecutor in Assange's case said that the United States has never, ever broken a diplomatic assurance. Well, that's simply not true. These documents show very clearly the United States broke its diplomatic assurances to Spain. The agreement to send Mendoza to Spain to serve his sentence was violated. This is undeniable. Only after suing both the United States and Spain, his own countries, was Mendoza allowed to return. Only after Spain's Supreme Court threatened to suspend the extradition treaty did the Americans finally allow Mendoza to go back. Mendoza had the Spanish Supreme Court, senior Spanish judges, and the Spanish public on his side. Assange does not. Assange is neither American nor British. In the event the U.S. violates its diplomatic assurances, which is practically guaranteed, Assange has no one to fight on his behalf, not even the Australian government. And given the special relationship between the U.S. and Britain, the idea that Britain would force the U.S. to abide by the extradition conditions is simply unrealistic. If the United States gives assurances to the United Kingdom in order to extradite Julian Assange, these assurances must be worded very explicitly and signed by all parties, including Assange, so that he may contest any noncompliance in court on his own behalf. When it comes to diplomatic assurances from the United States, it's not a question of, are these assurances enough? It's a question of, can these assurances be enforced once Julian Assange is in the United States? This is what the judges in the English High Court must ask themselves. While they still have the power to stop the United States from criminalizing journalism and violating Assange's human rights. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the VIRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
From its beginning, the promise of popular rule in the U.S. has been undermined by the power of racism, capitalism, and patriarchy, says Peter Bloom, journalist, in an article titled, "The Survival of U.S. Democracy is Under Threat." Stay tuned for more. With all that is happening in the United States and the world, it was perhaps all too easy to miss the ongoing battle for the future of U.S. democracy. Republicans have opened up new racist offenses against voter rights and are once more pushing through corrupt gerrymandering to rig elections in their favor. They're also blocking the Freedom to Vote Act that would curb systematic racist voter suppression through policies such as automatic registration at MVA, longer early voting, greater access to mail-in ballots, and fresh regulations for guaranteeing that people are not wrongly barred from voting and reducing partisan interference at the polls. It is no exaggeration to say that the very survivor of liberal democracy in the United States of America is under threat. This Republic strategy is just the latest example of a long history of repressing democracy in the United States of America. From its beginning, the promise of popular rule in the U.S. has been undermined by the power of racism, capitalism, and patriarchy. Further, so much of the nation's imperialism abroad and repression at home have been sanctioned by elected majorities. The effort to stop these Republican assault on democracy is an attempt to preserve the bare minimum of fairness in a system designed by and for elites. Fighting them is crucial for stemming the present spread of white power and corporate rule. Yet, it is also necessary for radically expanding democracy in the future beyond its liberal limits. The overriding aim of Republicans is to maintain power through rigging democracy. This desire is perhaps most blatant in its ongoing gerrymandering strategies. Again and again, they redraw district lines to ensure maximum Republican representation. Regardless of the actual makeup of voters this year, the new census results have provided a once-in-a-decade opportunity for many legislatures to redraw their electoral boundaries in ways that would maximize their partisan advantage. As one expert recently lamented, Republicans have control of the process in many states this year, and so far, they are maximizing their advantage whenever they can. The new lines will likely help Republicans retake control of the U.S. House next year. To be fair, Democrats are also guilty of such legislative chicanery, yet their push for the Freedom to Vote Act shows their desire to at least resign in these duplicitous practices. According to a report by the Brennan Center, if passed by Congress, the legislation would put in place the most transformative changes to the redistricting process in the country's history, including banning partisan gerrymandering, strengthening other protections for communities of color, making it easier for voters to get bad maps quickly struck down in court. The importance of passing this act, though, goes far beyond partisan policies. Gerrymandering and voter suppression laws are the last gasp to democratically protect a racist corporate status quo. The biggest fear of elites is to encourage all non-whites and working-class voters the chance to either cast a ballot against this racist political establishment or elect representatives who would actually challenge it once in power. Republicans and corporate interests backing them are ironically and tragically trying to use democracy against itself. They're seeking to justify their racist hypercapitalism through pretending it is supported by a majority of voters. It is a false perception that their regressive views are actually representative of the desires of U.S. citizens overall. The ultimate goal is to not just maintain but expand this racist capitalist oligarchy. The suppression and rigging of democracy at the ballot box is linked to the broader repression on democracy within the economic and social spheres of the United States. Right-wing political control is needed to push through an anti-worker and anti-civil rights agenda to combat calls for bottom-up change against a free market system that has rapidly increased inequality, incarceration, and imperialism. Just this year, Amazon used fundamentally broken anti-worker labor laws to defeat a vote by warehouse employees in Alabama to unionize. As these crises of racial capitalism only become more acute, so too will the need to use whatever reactionary Democrat means necessary to fight its resistance. Gerrymandering, far-right populist recalls of progressive politicians, and denying historically marginalized populations for their basic voting rights have and will be deployed by elites to decrease the democratic power of unions. Growing demands to defund the police and calls to end the overthrowing and undermining of democracy around the world by the U.S. military. There is a less publicized but a still serious danger to democracy posed by the current battle for the passage of the Freedom to Vote Act. It is to restrict the struggle for democracy to the narrow limits of liberalism. If Republicans want to actively restrict democracy to expand the power of white privilege and corporate oligarchy, status quo Democrats too often want to stop at simply preserving basic voting rights. Instead, this should be the first step in the progressive spread of democracy beyond traditional policies. It means promoting the democratic control of workplaces and community democracy initiatives such as participatory budgeting. It also entails providing global solidarity and real support for radical democratic movements challenging corporate power internationally. The battle for this act represents so much more than the defense of current democracy. It is the ongoing drive to radically expand the power of people over profits locally, nationally, and internationally. The very future of progressive democracy is under threat in the United States of America.
Start. Movement. Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم سلام عليكم dear listeners. Youth Station is on track.
It's the Youth Station for
right,
you.
That has to be
we're not.
You,
we can't move away. You can't change the slogan of the show.
Well, you have
the catchphrase of the slogan. You
know? So I'm Mehdi. Yeah. This is Muzaffar Haider Abbas.
Yeah, this is me.
Muzaffar Abbas Haider.
Yeah, that's right.
You almost forgot that. Yeah. I mispronounced your name.
Muzaffar is fine.
That's Muzaffar, yeah.
Nobody cares about my surname.
No one does. Okay. Yeah, so welcome to the show, guys. I was.
Oh, yeah, welcome, know. Everybody, yeah. Welcome. So Mehdi and Muzaffar show.
Boom, 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 inconsiderate. Boom, boom, boom. Yeah. Right. There's a hadith.
Yeah.
That you are going to be sifted and then sifted.
Whew. Allahu Akbar. Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
It's towards the end of times,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, go on. Go on. What does it say?
So towards the end of times, people will be sifted, and they'll be sifted again, and they'll be sifted again, until only the best of the best of the best remain. I don't know about you, I feel myself failing, you know? I'm falling through the sift. Yay, it's happening again. I'm going to the bottom of the food chain.
Over and over. No, yeah. So,
Allah protect us, honestly. The fitna of Akhir al-Zaman is one of those things that we often ask Allah to protect us from. min fitnat al-zaman. And fitna is like test. Corruption. It's, yeah, it's sometimes translated as test, but it's, when we use it, we're using it in the context of it being a corruption or confusion, right? Test as well. I mean, I guess these confusions are tests. Why are they testing you, right? It's not tribulation. Tribulation...
Easy, bro, you know, it depends where it's used. Fitna, if it's about the people, it's what you said. Yeah. If it's like fatannahu, like Allah says, I did that, it's like I tested them. So it depends on
But fitna tannas... It's the confusion that they create, right?
Right, yeah, yeah.
Where so, yeah, okay, well, let's go with test, because confusions are...
Tests. Yeah, the fair tests enough, are, yeah.
Yeah, confusing. They're supposed to be confusing. But anyway, the point is, that fitna, whatever that fitna is, of the akhiru zaman, of the final age, is so confusing and so compelling and so difficult that it has the capacity to filter out most of humanity. And only very, very few people will rise to the top. But sorry, I completely cut you off. I wanted to hear what you had to say.
Well, that's pretty much the discussion that I wanted to have. Is there are two societies, two environments that we have. We've got an Islamic environment. Alhamdulillah that we are in an Islamic environment over here. Right? Living here for a long time, we might not realize... And the things that we have around us that are Islamic, right? Yeah. And because the little things that we see not being practiced, we're going to get irritated. But in a general aspect, we do forget the immense aura of Islamic society around us, so right?
True. You hear the adhan at least?
At the very least, yeah. Ask those who are not here. Ask those who do not get these things, right? And who are... dying to live in this situation.
Man, back
like
in
this.
The UK, the Muslims are afraid, even in their little communities, to do the adhan out loud because, you know, people might complain about noise pollution and then, you know, Islamophobia and attacks against Muslims and then the whole fitna that it will actually create.
And yeah, but that's just the surface. Yeah. That's just the tip of the iceberg.
And that's just one example.
Let's assume that all of that is allowed because, you know, the British, the rulers, the policymakers, that's what we mean, right? That's what we mean when we talk about the West. We talk about America or stuff like that. We do not mean the people. We do not mean the individuals, right?
Of course not, yeah.
So these people, they are smart, right? They are clever. Cunning is the right word.
Cunning,
right?
Yeah.
They're cunning, right? They're going to lie to you. There used to be subtle ways to stop you from practicing your faith and stop your faith to become a part of your soul, right?
Okay.
How do we protect ourselves from those? Right now, in the textbooks, there's everything there is to manipulate your child into being growing up into a non-Islamic, non-religious.
Forget that, non-human. They're changing their genders out there, stuff man. Like they're becoming LGBT and stuff. So it's crazy, but yeah.
What is my shield?
Marriage. Number one thing, if you're going to be living in a non-Islamic environment, and you're going to be young as well, you're a youth, you need to get married. Take all those excuses that you have for not getting married and just chuck them in the bin.
This has to go out for the parents this time, for them. Seriously. I'm tired. And I know I'm not a person to be enforcing something, but for God's sake, get your children married. You know, get them married. I'm going to go for a break, gather my thoughts, and then go on again. Right, let's go for it.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back. So we're talking about the West and the things that we can do to protect our faith in a society like that, not necessarily the West.
You might be in a Hindu environment.
Anywhere that isn't an Islamic environment.
You might be in Japan or something, I don't know. Which is a heavily West-stoxified culture anyway.
I've never been able to understand the current Japanese situation.
Basically, they had honor and decency and integrity, like the samurai
culture. That's why I said current.
Back then, right, they had all those things, and then Western culture came in and basically reversed it.
Demolished
destroyed
everything
it
that they had that could be valued.
But so, the first thing, like, about marriage.
Yeah, even yeah. What I was talking about the parents is it was a piece of advice and a very humble request to the parents in the West is if you think that your child or the person is not suitable for your child because he is not hasn't reached his maximum potential in his material life, then please know that a person who is not deserving of living. If you think that person does not deserve your child or your child does not deserve that person because he has not reached his maximum potential yet, then I think they don't deserve them because it's inappropriate to think that when a person is at stage zero, a couple is supposed to grow together. You understand? It's not a person is, the person has reached everything that he wanted to become and he's done everything. Now he's ready to get married. That's incorrect.
Yeah, parents say, you know, you need to first have a job, first have a decent income, have a house, have a car.
Alhamdulillah, I'm married, but I'm going to say this. Like, if a woman doesn't want me right now because I'm not fully ready, then she does not deserve me when I'm fully ready.
You go, boy.
You know? You know what I'm saying? And that goes for the other case, like, other way around also, you know? Like, if I'm thinking, oh, that woman is not ready for me, then I don't deserve the woman when she's ready. You understand? So yeah, please get this one.
Guys, we just hammered this down. Number one is your shield, marriage.
Marriage. Yeah.
Number two, salah.
Salah.
You need to pray your salah. Doesn't matter what situation you are in.
On
you
time.
You need to pray.
Yeah. Try to pray
prayers.
On time.
You might be in an office environment. You might be embarrassed of praying. Shaitan comes to you and he says, if you pray, then you're gonna give bad reputation to your religion. If you are choosing to live in the West, then you are making a conscious decision to live in a non-Islamic environment.
And in those non-Islamic environments, they've got these slogans of, oh, freedom of this, freedom of practice, freedom of that. Use that. Exploit it to your own betterment.
Yeah, and they don't. That's the saddest thing.
Yeah.
You have the freedom to do something and you still don't do it? No, you have no excuse. You need to be a little bit proud as well. And another thing that happens in the West is, you know, there are different, and this happens in lots of places, where you go into a certain community. First, there's non-Muslims everywhere, right? 90% of people around you are non-Muslim, right? They are atheists, polytheists, whatever.
Yeah.
You finally find a community of Muslims, right? And you're happy, but 90% of them are Sunni. Right?
Yeah.
And so then you start feeling like, oh, what should I do here? Oh, what's wrong with you? Pick up your turba, put that bad boy down, and pray. Like, have some blooming courage for crying out loud.
Where that comes out from? Why that happens?
Why?
Because they're afraid of questions. We are afraid of questions. Why are we afraid of questions? Because we do not have the answers. I feel that what I'm doing is right, but I cannot, in a verbal debate, prove my faith, right? Yeah. So, which brings us to the third point.
Which is what?
Learning your faith.
Ahsant, yeah.
Right?
Third thing, you need to know your religion better.
Fair enough. If you can't be a full-fledged scholar, that's good. Okay, you can't. At least learn the basics that you practice on a daily basis.
Yeah.
But learn the reason behind those things, right? Another thing, understand your faith.
Everything that you're doing in life should be justified Islamically.
Yeah.
You should have the proper arguments for it. If a Christian comes to you, you know how to debate with them. If a Jew comes to you, if a Hindu comes to you, whatever, you know how to discuss with people in the best of manners, of course. Right?
There's another thing that people do face is, for example, people come to you and they're like, oh, why do you pray 3 times a day, 5 times a day, or why is your morning prayer only 2 units and stuff like that? Okay, these are different things. For example, I do not have to know why it's 2 units in the morning. Right? Because that's ta'budi. Ta'budi means something you have to submit. Right. But it's not the same as Trinity over here, you know, being like, just believe. That's why it is.
Very good point. Yeah. When it comes to your aqa'id, you need to, that's what we're talking about. You need to know.
You need to know. Why we blindly accept the 2-unit prayer in the morning is we have understood the fact and the truth behind that order of that. We have understood that is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We have proven for ourselves that Allah exists. That's a large debate what exists means. There's nothing but Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Son.
Right? After that, we have understood that the Prophet, peace be upon him, and it's 100% sure for us that he is his Prophet, and then the Quran and stuff like that. Right? From there, we have understood that 100% we've been told to pray 2 units a day. That's why we do it. We don't have to explain. Right.
Excellent. Marriage. prayers,
learning religion. Your faith.
What's number four?
Right, so I think I'm losing my breath. Let's go for a break and we'll go gather ourselves together after the break. Welcome back. Yeah, so we're going to carry on talking about what happens in the West and how we can... What can we use as a shield to guard our faith in the West? We talked about a certain things that you must remember. Go on with the fourth, bro.
The fourth one that you need to have in the West is respect your parents.
Oh, that is so heavy. That really is important. So heavy, and that that has some insight behind it. That has some insight behind it, yeah.
The world around you, your school, your friends, their parents will be divorced. They'll be swearing at their dad, swearing at their moms, and it's completely normal.
The system is going to give you this illusion of, you have the right against your parents. No, you don't.
Yes, and the system actually enforces it by law that, you know, if you're... dad hits you or something, you can report him for abuse, you know, and ridiculous things like this. It is absolutely ridiculous. It is absolutely un-Islamic. And I'm not saying that sometimes, obviously, it becomes out of hand. Like,
yeah,
to the point
it's not completely justified for a parent to be smacking their kid right, left and center. But
at the same time, we have to understand that that is a taghut. That is not an Islamic government. And
the Quran says that if you... get your what's rightfully yours. You get that from them, that's not right.
Yeah. And you know the definition of totalitarianism is this, that it invades into the personal sphere of your household. And this is precisely what the society is doing. Through even things like the media, right? Simpsons, Family Guy, and Malcolm in the Middle, and all of these sitcoms, all of these comedies, and they all show the dad to be an idiot, an imbecile. The general thing is not to respect your parents. Make fun out of your parents, right? Parents are silly. Parents. Islam is telling you that you need to respect them. Not obey them, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't obey your parents all the
time. Obey your parents. He doesn't... you don't mean...
don't obey your parents when they tell you to do something haram, right? Or they tell you to do something against the religion.
Yeah, for example, don't wear hijab.
Yeah.
Come on, man,
disobey your parents.
Yeah,
that
go ahead.
Example. But the general idea is that, look, you need to respect, love, show kindness to your parents.
Yeah.
Something that you lose very easily in the West. The West is a scary
place. Doesn't
let
it shape in the first place for you to lose it, you know? When you're growing up, you've got no sense of respect for your parents. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so we're out of time, I think. So
yeah, we could go on and on and on and on.
So number one, we had what? Marriage. Second, prayers. Third,
learning your faith.
Learning your faith. Fourth,
respecting your parents. I think that's probably the most time we have for today's program. That's all the time we have for today, and hopefully it does help you out in your daily lives, and it does help us out as a reminder. Me and Muzaffar Haider are off for today. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.